Sweet in the morning. Oh Lord, it's sweet in the morning.
And this is CPRMetro.org, Community Progressive Radio. My name is Bernard White. The name of this program is Wake Up Call. And I want to welcome you to this edition of Wake Up Call.
Sweet in the morning, 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 sweet in the morning. Sweet in the morning, 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 sweet in the morning.
Today on Wake Up Call, we have a lot of ground to cover. Significant earth and societal changing events are happening at a rapid pace. On Wake Up Call today, we plan to take a look at some of those events. It is our custom to always kick it off with a little bit of music. What we'll hear is from two groups. One is Lake Street Dive. They're going to do a tune called This Magic Moment. And also, we'll hear from Aretha Franklin and the Four Tops. This is Levi Stubbs' last performance and was wheeled out in a wheelchair and gave a touching performance.
Sweet in the morning.
Ha ha ha! magic moments, so different and so new, was like any other, until I looked at you and then it happened. Oh, it took me by surprise. I knew that you failed to do by looking your eyes, sweeter than wine, softer than a summer night. Everything I want I have whenever I hold you tight. Oh, oh, this magic moment, wow, your lips are close to mine, will last forever, forever till the end of time. Oh,
and it would be wonderful if you remain standing as I introduce this next gentleman to you. He is a dear and a very, very old friend of mine, not that old, but he's a world-class gentleman, he's a world-class superstar, and what makes it so good is he's our very, very own Mr. Levi Stubbs! Coming out to the groove with him.
Look like he needs to go to work for
me.
That's right.
Yes.
There's no crew on
the team. Mr. Levi, stop.
Bernadette.
I'll tell the world that you belong to me. I love it. How many nights have I run through my house talking about Bernadette? Still waters run deep. Yes, they do. Standing in the shadows of love. I mean, and I want to make it up to you. Hello. Hallelujah.
I believe in you and me. I believe that we will be in love eternally. Well, as far as I can see, you will always be the one.
me. Levi would love me.
I believe in dreams again. Never end, and like the river flows to the sea, I was lost, now I'm free,
I believe in you, you.
Believe yourself.
Yes. Come on. Hey. Say,
Levi. Don't hurt your pride. All the chips are now.
Say, Levi. Come on.
I will always be around.
Say, baby.
Just up for you.
Well.
My love. Girl.
Yes, I will never leave you. I will always let you in the places that no one
And now a deeper look at the legal details here with two former federal prosecutors experienced in handling high-stakes investigations and prosecutions. John Carlin ran the Justice Department's National Security Division from 2013 to 2016. Before that, he served as chief of staff and senior counsel to then-FBI Director Robert Mueller. And Peter Zeidenberg, whose 17 years as a federal prosecutor included time as deputy special counsel in the investigation into the leak of CIA officer Valerie Plame's identity. Gentlemen, welcome back to the NewsHour to both of you. John Carlin, to start with you, what's most significant about today's indictments?
Well, we have two things that happened today. We have the indictment, and then we have the release of a plea agreement and a statement of offense. And taking each in turn. So the indictment, what we see today, at least according to the allegations, is that the campaign manager of a major candidate who is now president was secretly taking millions and millions of dollars from the Ukrainian government that was one of Putin's Russia's closest allies. And just to explain who, for your viewers, who Yankovych is, this is someone who not only was so close to Russia that when he was deposed, he fled there in 2014,
right.
But it was him being overthrown that caused Putin's Russia to invade and seize part of the Ukraine that led to the still in effect sanctions. So that's the significance there. With Papadopoulos and the plea agreement today, we now know that there's an individual who's been cooperating for months, and that there's someone who was on the campaign, and while he was on the campaign, was talking to people he knew were in touch with Russian officials to get damaging information about the opposing campaign, including hearing all the way back on April 26th, according to the statement of offense of 2016, that they had thousands of emails from Clinton's campaign.
So, Peter Zeidenberg, you've had a chance to look at these plea agreements and also the plea agreement and the indictments. What do they say to you?
Well, it says to me they got a big problem at the White House. The Papadopoulos plea agreement suggests that there are at least three individuals that were involved with the campaign that were fully aware of Mr. Papadopoulos' connection with Russia, and he was advising. He sent an email saying Russia updates. And this is after the campaign And the administration has been saying for many, many months, no connection with Russia, no collusion, no cooperation, no connection of any kind. And now we know that at least three people besides Papadopoulos were aware that he was trying to reach out and, in fact, had reached out to Russian government officials.
So, and the White House, and more to talk about here, but I was struck that the White House today was emphatic, John Carlin, and saying, well, but this happened in terms of what Mr. Manafort and Mr. Gates did well before the Trump campaign. It didn't have anything to do with what the Trump campaign was doing.
Well, I'll just say, according to the document that we've seen today, that while he was the campaign manager for the Trump campaign, the whole point of the statute that these allegations say that Manafort violated and his aide, the Foreign Agent Registration Act, is to be transparent when you're receiving money from a foreign government.
Right.
So if you're acting on their behalf, the American people know. And the problem here is that he wasn't. He wasn't transparent. And so in that sense, it's a big deal.
And we heard his lawyer, we heard Paul Manafort's lawyer, Peter Zeidenberg, say, well, this has only been used, I think he said, a handful of times in the last many, many decades and only once successfully.
That's true. It is a rarely used statute. But, man, if you're going to use it, this is the case to use it for. Here you've got an enormous amount of money from a country that is trying to influence our election. I mean, this is like a paradigm of why the statute is written, so that if you were going to bring a case, this is the case to bring.
So let's come back to George Papadopoulos and that plea agreement, John Carlin. Again, going back to what the White House's reaction, they said, well, this is somebody with an extremely limited role. He wanted to do things for the campaign. He kept being turned away. So they're trying to, I mean, they're putting as much distance as they can between the campaign and anything he did.
Okay, not commenting on the White House, but looking at the statement of the offense, it wasn't just that Papadopoulos, while working as a member of the national security team, and the statement of offense takes pains to point out that he attended a meeting with the president of the United States while working on the campaign in March of that year. But it's also that he was reporting what he was doing back up to campaign officials. As Peter points out, at least three officials, they're not named, but it says they were campaign officials, and he's emailing them while he's talking to these representatives of the Russian government. So there's definitely more to find out there.
So what does that tell us, Peter Zeidenberg? I mean, are we closer to knowing whether there was collusion? And remind everybody what it would mean to prove collusion, coordination,
well,
between a campaign.
There's no legal term of art,
right,
for collusion. The crime, if there was one, would be conspiracy. And this is all the hallmarks of a conspiracy. It's not charged as a conspiracy, but it certainly wouldn't be a stretch to say that there's coordination and a goal of getting this information to the campaign. He was encouraged by one of these officials to take the meeting in Moscow. And he had explained...
One of the campaign officials.
By the campaign officials. Right. So, I mean, the dots are all lined up. All you got to do is take the pencil and draw the line.
What does this say to you, John Carlin, about how... I mean, we're not able to talk to Robert Mueller. I mean, he's been operating very much behind closed doors. But what does it say to you about his approach to what he has and what he may have going forward?
Well, I think the one thing that's clear, as we knew, is that he was going to take the facts where they led. And if anyone could act quickly and assemble a team and bring charges quickly, it's him. These are serious charges. It's actually a relatively short period of time to bring as substantive as an indictment as you see. And when you have someone who's pled guilty and continued to cooperate, you can tell there's more work to do in the investigation. But one point I don't think should be lost is just, we talked about where it might go, but to just take a step as to where we are before we start changing our expectations as to what's normal and what's not. This is more information of historic importance that we just haven't seen before about a Russian campaign, and here another government as well, that ends up influencing our presidential election, our core of what it is to be a democratic country. And that's not partisan. That's a problem that needs to be addressed across party line.
And Peter Zeidenberg, what do you say to those listening, watching out there who may be saying, well, it's just an indictment. It's just a charge. None of this has been proven.
Well, actually, Papadopoulos is not just a charge. He's pled guilty and will be cooperating. And it sounds like these are, there is an email trail that goes on. And I guarantee you that the three campaign advisors have been interviewed. And they may be cooperating as well. They may have corroborated this as well. And if they've contradicted it, they either will be charged or may already have been charged. So there are a lot more shoes to drop here for sure.
Peter Zeidenberg, John Carlin, just the beginning. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Why did the president call the U.S. justice system a joke and a laughing stock during his comments in the Capitol?
That's not what he said.
He said that the system of justice in this country is a
process.
Joke.
He said the process has people calling us a joke and calling us a laughing stock. Look, I think, as I told Margaret, he's simply pointing out his frustration of how long that this process takes, how costly this process is, and particularly for someone to be a known terrorist, that process shouldn't move faster. That's the point he's making. That's the frustration he has.
Separate subject, if I could, just other folks have a couple of questions each. Getting back to George Papadopoulos, does the president recall at that March 31st, 2016 meeting of his National Security Advisory Board, Mr. Papadopoulos suggesting the meeting between then-candidate Trump and Vladimir Putin? Does he recall that?
No, I don't believe he does. April.
Sarah, two questions. First, Mary Frances Berry, the former head of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, says everyone wants better. But to stop people from coming because they come from different countries is totally wrong. What say you?
Nobody said because they come from a different country. I think that's the whole definition of immigration, is that they wouldn't be U.S. citizens. We certainly haven't said that immigration as a whole should be outlawed. So
the diversity lottery is specifically for those coming from other nations that you are not favoring right now because you believe that there is a possibility of terrorism.
I believe that we have a fundamental right to protect the people of this country. And if we see or think that someone is a threat to United States citizens, that we should take every precaution that we can to protect the people of this country. And I don't think most Americans would disagree with that. In fact, most Americans do support extreme vetting and certainly support the protection of the citizens of this country.
And second question, last question, compromise, the issue of compromise. What is the definition of compromise as it relates to slavery and the Civil War?
Look, I'm not going to get in and relitigate the Civil War. It's like I told you yesterday, I think I've addressed the concerns that a lot of people had and the questions that you had, and I'm not going to relitigate history here.
When you left, so, and I'm going to ask the question again.
Why don't you ask it in the way that you're apparently accusing me of being?
I'm not accusing. I'm asking a question, Sarah, seriously. The question is, does this administration believe, does this president believe slavery was wrong? And before you answer, Mary Frances Berry, a historian, said in 1860 there was a compromise. The compromise was to have southern states keep slavery, but the Confederacy fired on Fort Sumter that caused the Civil War. And because of the Civil War, what happened? The North won.
I think it is disgusting and absurd to suggest that anyone inside of this building would support slavery. Peter.
Yesterday from that podium, you said all of our leaders have flaws, Washington, Jefferson, Roosevelt, and Kennedy. What are President Trump's flaws?
Probably that he has to deal with you guys on a daily basis.
In fairness, he doesn't deal with us on a daily basis. So what would you say in sincerity?
Most every day, actually,
so
he does.
What are his flaws, then, I guess? Simple question.
No, I just gave you one. John.
Sarah, in the hours, and in fact, the days after the horrific shooting in Las Vegas, the president repeatedly said, now is not the time to talk about policy. Now is not the time to talk about politics. That's for another time. Right now, we need to mourn the dead. Yet this morning, the president launched into a political argument with Senator Chuck Schumer on Twitter, literally hours after this incident yesterday. Why was he so quick to go the political route and point fingers at Chuck Schumer for the fact that this person was in the country at all.
Well, look, this wasn't about going the political route. This is something that, frankly, the president's been talking about for a long time. This isn't a new policy. This isn't a new position. This isn't a new conversation. The president has been talking about extreme vetting and the need for that for the purpose of protecting the citizens of this country since he was a candidate, long before he was ever president. This isn't a new argument. This isn't a new position. And this wasn't new for the president to speak about it. Kristen.
Sarah, I want to follow up on the question John was asking you earlier. You're making the case that these are not new policies he's talking about. And yet the question still remains. He is delving into a policy and political discussion, and he and you were very clear after the Las Vegas shooting that it wasn't appropriate to talk about policy. So what's the difference now?
I said it wasn't appropriate to politicize the conversation, which I don't believe we are. We're talking about protecting American lives, and there are things that this president has consistently and repeatedly talked about, advocated for, pushed for, introduced executive orders for, supported legislation for, time and time again since long before he was even president of the United States, that support this position. It's not a new position. There are facts that we know about this horrific tragedy that we know caused some of the things in this horrific tragedy that I think determine what those policy positions that he's been advocating for long before yesterday are very consistent with the activity that could have prevented something like this from happening.
The president invokes Chuck Schumer's name, so how can you argue that it's not a political argument that he's making?
Look, Senator Schumer has supported these opposing policies, and I think that that is a very basic fact. Margaret.
He's not unifying the country. Is he failing to unify the country at this
moment? He helped implement them on the front end long before the Gang of Eight. And the Gang of Eight would have only addressed one part of that problem, as we've talked about many times before. He may have helped isolate one part of the problem, but it would have exacerbated so many other parts of the problem that fall within our immigration system. If you only address one part and not in the totality of it and introduce a fully and more responsible immigration reform like the president has proposed, like the president has outlined, then you're not addressing the problem, you're not fixing the problem, you're only making things worse.
Sarah, the president talked about wanting merit-based immigration today and then criticized the diversity visa program. Is he aware that the diversity visa program actually does have a merit-based component to it?
Look, there may be a component of it, but the fact that we have a lottery system that randomly decides who gets the greatest opportunity in the world, one of the best things that we have in this country is the fact that everybody wants to be here. And to give that away randomly, to have no vetting system, to have no way to determine who comes, why they're here, and if they want to contribute to society is a problem. And the president strongly supports making sure that the people that come here want to be here for the right reasons and not to bring harm to our country. And I don't think that's something that any American shouldn't want to support. Jim?
Are ranked by their job that they have had, and they have to have minimum education.
Peter, the whole idea is that they are randomly selected. This isn't
criteria and having certain rankings. It's not entirely
it's the
random.
Lowest level of criteria that any part of our immigration system has is through the lottery system. And so to try to argue that this is a system that thoroughly vets people is just shows a total lack of understanding for what this process is.
No comments since the Uzbek gentleman yesterday came in. 350,000 people come to the country on this program. One of them now apparently has been accused of a terrorist act. One out of 350,000 create a problem then for that program?
There may be more. Look, all I know is that you can't randomly select people and not have them thoroughly vetted and not have the ability to know whether or not these people want to do good things or bad things when they get here. I don't think it's unreasonable to ask that people that want to come to this country go through a vetting process to make sure that when they get here, they want to contribute to society and not harm the people of this country. Jordan?
On Senator Schumer, can you tell us when is the last time he and the president spoke? And more broadly, the president saying that he is responsible, at least in part, for this attack. Does the president still see him
Before
as someone?
Before you go any further, let me be really clear. The president has not blamed Senator Schumer and doesn't feel that the senator is responsible for the attack. We believe very strongly that the individual who carried out the attack is responsible and no one else. However, we do think that there are policies that could be put in place that help protect American citizens. We've been talking about those for a long time, and we continue to push and advocate for those policies.
Does the president still see Senator Schumer as someone he can work with?
I think we'd love to work with Senator Schumer to pass legislation on extreme vetting, and if he's willing to do that, we would absolutely welcome his support on it. I'm going to take one last question.
Sarah. Thank you, Sarah.
Right here.
Thank you, Sarah. Will President look for President Trump look for enhancing anti-terror measures with other foreign countries during his visit to Asia? And also, will President Trump call the leaders of Argentina and Belgium to express his condolence?
I believe that arrangements are being made for him to speak with the leaders of those countries. They're working between the two teams to set that up. In terms of looking for conversations around anti-terrorism, that will certainly be discussed throughout the trip over the next several days. And as I said earlier this week, General McMaster will be here tomorrow to discuss the trip in more detail and certainly in more depth for the briefing tomorrow. Thanks so much and have a good day. We'll let you know later today what time that should be. Both will most likely take place in the afternoon. Thanks, guys.
It's The Real News. I'm Aaron Maté. The Trump administration's white supremacist sympathies are again on display. In a Fox News interview, White House Chief of Staff John Kelly called Confederate General Robert E. Lee a good man and said the Civil War arose from the lack of an ability to compromise.
I would tell you that Robert E. Lee was an honorable man. He was a man that gave up his country to fight for his state, which in 150 years ago was more important than country. It was always loyalty to state first back in those days. Now it's different today. But the lack of an ability to compromise led to the Civil War. And men and women of good faith on both sides made their stand where their conscience had them make their stand.
Just to correct myself, as you heard, he called him an honorable man, not a good man. Kelly's comments sparked outrage, but instead of an apology, the White House today stood by his comments.
I don't know that I'm going to get into debating the Civil War, but I do know that many historians, including Shelby Foote and Ken Burns' famous Civil War documentary, agree that a failure to compromise was a cause of the Civil War. There are a lot of historians that think that, and there are a lot of different versions of those compromises. I'm not going to get up here and relitigate the Civil War, but there's certainly, I think, some historical documentation that many people, and there's pretty strong consensus, people from the left, the right, the North, and the South, that believe that if some of the individuals engaged had been willing to come to some compromises on different things, then it may not have occurred.
These latest words from the White House come days after white supremacists held a White Lives Matter rally in Shelbyville, Tennessee. Joining me is Gerald Horn, historian and professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston. Professor Horn, welcome. I guess I'll ask you to respond to General Kelly's comments, and then also this follow-up from White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders today, that there is some kind of consensus across the spectrum amongst historians that this idea that a compromise could have averted the Civil War is correct.
Well, first of all, there's a consensus amongst neo-Confederate historians that substantiate what General Kelly said. You know that quite recently, Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee referred to the White House as an adult daycare center. We had thought that that adult daycare center had one occupant, that is to say, the chief executive who now occupies the Oval Office. We see now that the man we thought was one of his minders, General Kelly, is actually an occupant of this adult daycare center himself, because what he represented was the reality that obviously he did not attend history class in the fourth grade. Indeed, he did not attend history class in kindergarten. If he had, he would have learned about something called the Missouri Compromise of 1820, which sought to bridge the unbridgeable gap between slaves and slave owners by allowing Missouri to enter the Union as a slave state and allowing Maine the Union as a so-called free state. Up to 1860 and 1861, when the Civil War erupted, there were numerous attempts to have compromises, including enacting a so-called fugitive slave law that compelled states like New York and New Jersey to return enslaved Africans who had fled Dixie to Dixie, despite the fact we are repeatedly told by those in Dixie to this very day, and certainly then, that states' rights, that is to say, the states' rights to own enslaved Africans, was the heart and soul of their project, including in 2017. Now, I think we should be clear that this is not just a misstep by General Kelly or just a misstatement of history. What he's trying to do is much more nefarious. He's trying to pave the way for the resurgence of these so-called white nationalists, these white supremacists who marched in Charlottesville, Virginia, just 6 weeks ago, and are bent upon imposing their diktat from the Atlantic to the Pacific. That is precisely what is at stake as we speak.
I want to go to one more clip of Kelly from that Fox News interview, where he had some words to say about history in general and looking back on experiences from the past. This is what he said.
There's certain things in history that were not so good and other things that were very, very good. I think we make a mistake, though, in as a society and certainly as individuals, when we take what is today accepted as right and wrong and go back 100, 200, 300 years or more and say what those, you know, what Christopher Columbus did was wrong. 500 years later, it's inconceivable to me that you would take what we think now and apply it back then. I think it's just very, very dangerous. And it shows you what how much of a lack of appreciation of history and what history is.
So that's Kelly saying that it's inconceivable to look back with a moral judgment on the actions of someone like Christopher Columbus, who sparked the genocide of the North American continent's indigenous population. Professor Horn, as a historian, I'm wondering your thoughts on Kelly's words there about history.
Well, obviously, Mr. Kelly needs to return to elementary school. Not only that, but what he says reeks of hypocrisy. Recall that it was not so long ago that the United States was instructing the citizens of what was then called Yugoslavia about the mandate and necessity to face their history, no matter how ugly it might be, so that they can advance into the future. On this, the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution, the United States is instructing Moscow to face its history, no matter how ugly it might be. With regard to the United States, however, we're supposed to cover up history. We're supposed to forget the fact that the seizing of North America was one of the largest thefts in the history of humankind, to the point where there should be a yellow police tape surrounding the entire borders of the United States of America. Not only that, but the double standard is even more insidious because it's not even applied consistently by its very definition. I mean, for example, today we're marking the 500th anniversary of Martin Luther nailing his 95 theses on the doors of a Catholic church in Germany. Now, most of the analyses that we've seen thus far, even though they talk about Martin Luther's role in Protestant faith, do not shrink from denouncing his anti-Semitism and denouncing his bias against Jewish people. But somehow, in the United States, we're supposed to forget about genocide against Native Americans. We're supposed to forget about mass enslavement of Africans. And once again, I don't think this is just a misstep of history. It is in sync with the more pernicious strategy of seeking to pave the way for the resurgence of white supremacists and white nationalists who once again marched in Charlottesville some six odd weeks ago.
Professor Horn, going back to something you said earlier about how In fact, contrary to what Kelly said, compromises were made well ahead of the Civil War. This is also a point that the writer Ta-Nehisi Coates made today on Twitter, and he pointed out that Abraham Lincoln even agreed to pay reparations to slave owners in a bid to make a deal with them. So why weren't these, or how were these compromise, so-called compromise efforts by Lincoln not sufficient for the South?
Well, you need to realize that even though it might be forgotten conveniently in 2017, those who spearheaded the secession of the so-called Confederate States of America in 1861 thought with good reason that they were marching in the footsteps of those who seceded from the British Empire in 1776. The secession from the British Empire was driven in no small measure by the desire to continue the enslavement of Africans, which George Washington and company thought had been jeopardized by Somerset's case in London in June 1772, which abolished slavery in England. They thought that decision would leap across the Atlantic to imperil their vast fortunes in the bodies of Africans, so they seceded. Keep in mind as well that in 1836, Sam Houston and Stephen Austin in Texas seceded from Mexico because Mexico in the 1820s had abolished slavery. And Mexico in the 1820s even had a president of African descent, Vicente Guerrero. Therefore, in 1861, the so-called Confederate States of America were in no mood to accept a compromise. They thought that they were on the right side of history. And sadly and unfortunately and tragically, that thumbnail sketch of history I've just outlined for you has been forgotten conveniently, not least by occupant number two, John Kelly, in the adult daycare center known as the White House.
And the irony here, Professor Horn, I'm wondering if you can comment on that for so many months now, we've heard General Kelly referred to as one of the so-called adults in the room, this sober voice of reason who was going to keep Trump in check. I'm wondering your thoughts on that and the historical parallels of that and whether we've seen a similar dynamic before where so many people have put their faith in the officials around the president, hoping that they will keep the president in check.
Well, obviously, that's laughable. The fact of the matter is that Mr. Trump was voted into office by 63 million people who are staying with him, even though his campaign chairman has just been indicted and a foreign policy advisor has just pled guilty to lying to the FBI. I think that we would be naive if we thought that those 63 million, including General Kelly, by the way, are simply victims of false consciousness. I think that those 63 million, in a sense, have an acute, though distorted, view of history, where they recognize, contrary to the opinion of some of our liberal and progressive friends, that history does not always move forward. It can move backwards. And therefore, you can have the clock of history turned back, and I dare say that is the prime agenda of Mr. Trump and the Oval Office, assisted, I'm afraid, by General Kelly.
We'll leave it there. Gerald Horn, historian and professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us on The Real News.
You guys remember John Boehner, former Speaker of the House, dude that would cry a lot, had a really weird skin color that looked a little too orange to be natural? Well, he apparently spent 18 hours speaking to Tim Alberta of Politico. And in those 18 hours, he unleashed. He unleashed on individuals that you would not expect him to unleash on, and it was fantastic. So we have some of the highlights from the interviews for you. And first, let me say that I love the way that the piece began. It started with, at 67, Boehner is liberated to say what he spent many years trying not to say, to smoke his two packs a day without undue stress, to chuckle at the latest crisis in Washington, and whisper to himself those three magic words, not my problem.
You know what? It actually makes me envy him a little bit.
Like,
he's
a little bit.
Yeah, he's totally out of the game. Like, in my ideal vision, we pass the 28th Amendment, we get money out of politics, progressives are in charge, and I'm out there smoking cigarettes with John Boehner somewhere laughing.
Hopefully you're smoking something else, but not cigarettes.
Right. I'm probably not smoking cigarettes, and I am probably smoking something else.
Yeah.
And that is going to be a great day in America. All right, so what did he say?
All right, so let's move on. He talks about Trey Gowdy. Now, Trey Gowdy has replaced chairman of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, and that was Jason Chaffetz, right? Now, let's go to graphic 51. Here's what Boehner has to say about Trey Gowdy. Gowdy, that's my guy. Even though he doesn't know how to dress, fuck Jordan. Fuck Chaffetz. They're both assholes.
Damn.
Whoa.
Shots fired.
Okay, so already, you know, balls to the wall. He is not holding back.
Okay, the Jordan he's referring to is Representative Jim Jordan.
Right. Boehner's beef with Chaffetz is that he's a total phony who possess legislative talent but focus mostly on self-promotion. With Chaffetz, Boehner says, it's always about Chaffetz.
Okay, so that's awesome for a couple of reasons. Number one, it's absolutely true. Mm-hmm. Number two, Chaffetz basically proved him right by resigning instead of doing the oversight of Donald Trump, which was too hard a job and could get him in political trouble. And where did he go? He went right, running right after the spotlight, went to Fox News, cashed some checks, get his PR out there so he could run for governor later. On the other hand, really, John, are you any better? I mean, what did you look at what a phony you are. How come you didn't say this stuff when you were in office? You waited till you're out of office to tell us what you actually think. This is why people hate politicians. And this is partly why Donald Trump has been successful. He might be a madman, but at least he's spouting off at the mouth while he's in office, right? And attacking people, etc.
Yeah.
So apparently, I mean, how much more would I respect John Boehner if while he's in office, he doesn't have to use the F-bomb or anything like that, but he could say, hey, you know what, Chaffetz is not genuine. Mm-hmm. He doesn't actually believe the things that he claims are his conservative principles. He's doing it for election reasons, so I'm voting no against Chaffetz. That would have been amazing.
Look, I completely agree with you in the necessity for honesty, especially among those who have some constructive criticism for members of their own party. We could definitely use more of that. Things have become much too tribalistic. However, at the same time, I hate that you use Trump as an example, because Trump has, in my opinion, led to more divisiveness. I'm not one of those people who's like, decorum is important. I mean, you hear some of the rhetoric on the show. But I think that things have devolved so much under Trump in terms of the way people communicate with one another that I'd like to scale it back considerably, right? Because it's become juvenile.
I hear you. And then Rand Paul had that great line about how Donald Trump does truth-telling without the truth. So that's also deeply problematic. But again, to Boehner's hypocrisy, okay, Chaffetz is going on the spotlights at Fox News, but so are you, Boehner. You also go on Fox News. So, mm-hmm. You know, it's convenient to be able to do this when he's out of power. So now, but he's not done yet.
All right, so going back to Jim Jordan, he says the following. Jordan was a terrorist as a legislator, going back to his days in the Ohio House and Senate, a terrorist. A legislative terrorist.
Okay, that's some strong words, dude.
Terrorist.
I like it. I like it. And of course, he's referring to these radical right wingers who would come out and go, I'm holding up the legislation. Why? Because I want more tax cuts for the rich, as an example. Now, Boehner is not saying that. But that's usually what they want, right?
You know, interestingly enough, most of the people that he's critical of in this piece are individuals that he considers too far to the right. Now, John Boehner is not liberal in any way, shape, or form.
He's not remotely.
Exactly. He's rather conservative. So he has a problem with people being too far to the right, which, I mean, I think we're seeing some of that ideology playing out in Trump's administration. Now, let's move on to Sean Hannity, because I love this part. Okay, so he says, I had a conversation with Sean Hannity probably about the beginning of 2015. I called him and said, listen, you're nuts. We had this really blunt conversation. Things were better for a few months, and then it got back to being the same old, because I wasn't going to be a right-wing idiot.
Damn.
Now, this is speculation on my part, but that was around the time that Trump announced that he was going to run. And so I'm guessing that Hannity's support for Trump might have concerned Boehner. Boehner claims that he's good friends with Trump, but he seems to be critical of Trump's administration as well.
So just a context there. So for example, sometimes what Ted Cruz would do, he would hold up the Senate. Now Boehner was in the House, so that's why he's talking about House guys. But he would say, okay, I'm not letting us fund the government because I want to make sure we repeal Obamacare. Now that's being a legislative terrorist in Boehner's words, because he knows that during the Obama years, they had absolutely no chance of repealing Obamacare because a guy named Obama would veto it. So that was grandstanding and being a phony. And they did a lot of that at the House too with these right wingers like Jim Jordan and Chaffetz. So that's what he's annoyed at. And then the Sean Hannitys of the world would aid and abet that and go, why isn't Boehner shutting down the government? Well, you know that that's an idiotic point, that there's no way you could win, and you're doing it for publicity. And Hannity and all those talk show hosts went along with that because all they wanted was to rile up their own side, even though they knew they had no chance of winning in that case.
Now, Sean Hannity did not take kindly to Boehner's remarks in this Politico interview, so he attacked Boehner on Twitter with the following tweet. He said, John, were you sober when you said this? That conversation never happened. I'm sorry, you are bitter and you failed.
Yeah, well, he was the Speaker of the House, and for the great majority of that time, you were kissing his ass, Sean. And I remember how you talked about, the Republicans are awesome and they were fantastic. Thank God John Boehner took away the gavel from Nancy Pelosi. John Boehner. And then it became inconvenient to be up Boehner's ass, and you moved into another set of buttocks. And from there, you shouted against Boehner. So I'm amused that you're calling him drunk, because he largely was. But that's the thing that you would have found outrageous if a progressive pointed out at the time. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know what portion of this interview was done intoxicated. But if it was, I love it, because it apparently led him to saying things that are true mm-hmm. and honest. And so, but I like that all of a sudden Hannity's feigning outrage that John Boehner might have a drinking issue.
Yeah. No, I mean, think about it. We have moved even further to the right. Like, that's what I got out of this more than anything, because Boehner was essentially forced into early retirement, right? And part of the reason why was because those in the Freedom Caucus didn't like him. Again, he wasn't right wing enough. That's insane to me. Like, we have actually moved backwards as a country. I mean, we already kind of knew that with the current administration that we have in place. But Boehner was the ultra conservative guy that we were critical of years ago. And now all of a sudden, he seems like he's somewhat reasonable sometimes.
Yeah, look, real quick, the dynamic here, and Anna's right, this is the most important part of the story, is how they moved over to Window so massively to the right. So John Boehner was an enormous right winger, and that faction of the party always wanted tax cuts for the rich and for multinational corporations. But the more extreme right wing of the party wanted bigger tax cuts and bigger deregulation. And in some ways, I'm thankful for that. And this sounds like a weird thing to say, right? Why? Because Boehner actually could have struck a grand bargain with Obama. Obama wanted to do that. And if they had, they would have cut Social Security and they would have given more tax cuts to the rich. Mm-hmm. And so Boehner is, don't get misunderstand, Boehner is not remotely a good guy. It's fun that he's saying these outrageous and correct things. But what Boehner wanted to do was to rob you guys in an efficient way. And he was frustrated that the Jordan and the Chaffetz and the Hannitys of the world were so stupid, the right-wing idiots. We had a good robbery planned. We were all going to make a lot of money. Yeah. And he went and got so greedy. And the Koch brothers and Adelson were so greedy that they pushed you guys to want even more tax cuts and even more deregulation and to absolutely pulverize Social Security and Medicare. But unfortunately, those guys won. And here we are in Trump land, where that's exactly what they're planning.
Yeah. So he has a little more criticism for those in the right-wing media. Boehner says, I always liked Rush Limbaugh. When I went to Palm Beach, I would always meet with Rush and we'd go play golf. But you know, who was that right-wing guy, Mark Levin? He went really crazy right and got a big audience, and he dragged Sean Hannity to the dark side. He dragged Rush to the dark side. And these guys, I used to talk to them all the time, and suddenly they're beating the living shit out of me. So, you know, friends become foes. Again, he's not considered right-wing enough.
Well, so a couple of really interesting points in that, too. So it shows you. Rush Limbaugh and John Boehner were buddies, and they would go golfing and have a grand old time and plan out what to say to Rush's audience. And they had a good deal, okay? And Limbaugh once famously accidentally said after an election that the Republicans lost, I'm tired of carrying their water. What happened, Rush? I thought you were an independent voice who was just a good conservative, and you cared about conservative principles, and you weren't working for the Republican Party as their propaganda outlet. Well, now we find out, no, you were. Mm-hmm. It wasn't about your own opinions. It wasn't about your own principles. First, you agreed with Boehner, but then you saw there was a bigger audience with Levin, Levin or whatever he calls himself. And then finally, the other part of the puzzle that is not in this piece is that Rush Limbaugh now gets financed by some of those extreme Koch brothers groups. Mm-hmm. They buy ads. They don't sell anything. Not like they don't sell sneakers or cars or anything like that. They buy ads on Rush's program. So he is also in. He's like, John, it was nice playing golf with you, but these guys are paying me millions of bucks to do propaganda. I don't have any real opinions. He's just a paid shill. That's who Rush Limbaugh is. This helps to partly expose him. So that's nice.
Yeah. Now, finally, there was a little tiny sliver of, I don't want to say love, but fairness toward Barack Obama, which I did not expect. Here's what he had to say about that. People thought in 2009, 2010, 2011 that the country couldn't be divided more. And you go back to Obama's campaign in 2008. You know, he was talking about the divide and healing the country and all of that. And some would argue on the right that he did more to divide the country than to unite it. I kind of reject that notion. Interesting. It was modern day media and social media that kept pushing people further right and further left. People started to figure out they could choose where to get their news. And so what do people do? They choose places they agree with, reinforcing the divide. So he's basically saying, no, this criticism about Obama dividing the country isn't correct. The media is at play. People wanting to remain in their ideological bubbles is a huge problem. And so we need to look at that and do something about that, which I thought was fair of him to say.
It is now. But of course, again, this is what drives a lot of people crazy about politicians, including me. When he was in office, Boehner perpetuated that and kept saying, oh, we're not doing obstruction. It's Obama that's doing the obstruction. He should be doing beer summits. And if he did, we'd all be getting along. Now that he's retired and out of politics, he's like, yeah, I was just messing with you guys. I was lying the whole time. No, Obama wasn't dividing us at all. And then finally, the last part of it is he says, oh, the media on the left and the right are dividing us. What media on the left? It's not like Boehner knows anything online. You know, I'd be shocked if he knows about the Young Turks. Mm-hmm. So he's not referring to us. Like what? MSNBC filled with Republicans and a couple of progressives in primetime is somehow dividing the country and making it more left? It's preposterous. All there is on television is right wingers and like two progressives. So no, that's not what's happening. It's the right wing purposely dividing the country for their own benefit. It's us versus Mexicans, us versus Muslims, us versus gays, us versus women. They're the only ones doing the dividing. And even if the left were really strong in the media, which, you know, is it's all the media he's referring to is almost purely multinational corporations that are multi-billion dollar entities and not remotely liberal. But even if that were the case, what their message would be, no, we should be united. We should treat everyone equally. Wow, how divisive.
Welcome to On Contact. Today we discuss the nature of policing in the United States with sociologist Alex Vitale.
Policing is about a war footing that the public or large segments of it are the enemy to be controlled, and that the way you manage social problems is through more firepower.
On Contact with Chris Hedges. The so-called professionalization of the police, the standard response to police brutality, has always resulted in more resources, militarized weapons, and money given to the police. It has been accompanied, at the same time, by less police accountability and greater police autonomy to strip citizens of their rights, as well as the expansion of the use of lethal force. Our national conversation on race and crime is based on a fiction. It is the fiction that the organs of internal security, especially the judiciary and the police, can be adjusted, modernized, or professionalized to make possible a post-racial America. We discuss issues of race while ignoring the economic, bureaucratic, and political systems of exploitation, all of it legal and built into the ruling apparatus, that are the true engines of exploitation, racism, and white supremacy. No discussion of race is possible without a discussion of capitalism and class. And until that discussion takes place, despite all the proposed reforms to the criminal justice system, the state will continue to murder and imprison poor people of color with impunity. RT correspondent Anya Parampel looks at the expansion of police powers.
Gone are the days of water hoses, batons, and police dogs. Though those images were startling enough, today police forces around the country look like full-fledged armies. The riot cop has evolved quite a bit over the last years, with billy clubs now replaced with shotguns. And that's no accident. Police departments around the country are equipped with military equipment thanks to the federal government. The White House says over $5 billion worth of military equipment has been transferred to state, local, and tribal police forces nationwide, including M16s and M14s, bayonets, night vision goggles, armored trucks, and mine-resistant vehicles. This is all thanks to the 1033 program, established by the National Defense Authorization Act of 1997. It allows for the federal government to ship weapons of war to domestic police departments. This gear is not only used to suppress public demonstrations, it can also show up in your private home through SWAT raids. According to the ACLU, 7% of such raids are usually to resolve hostage crises, while 79% of raids are conducted over search warrants, often drug-related. In 1995, there were about 30,000 SWAT raids conducted in the United States, or about 82 a day. By 2015, there are at least 136 SWAT raids a day on private American homes. According to the ACLU, during these intense raids, weapons or drugs are found about 35% of the time. This year, the Trump administration announced it was rolling back restrictions put in place by the Obama administration on the 1033 program, though a report from the GAO already found the limits had largely been ineffective to begin with.
And we will save taxpayer money in the process. There's not a dollar to waste, and we're not going to waste a dollar. We're not going to allow equipment no longer needed to be sitting idle when you could be using it.
Meaning, this trend of police militarization is only going to continue.
Thank you, Anya. I'm joined today by Alex Vitale. He is a professor of sociology at Brooklyn College and the author of The End of Policing. He's a senior advisor to the Police Reform Organizing Project and serves on the New York State Advisory Committee to the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. So let's talk about what we're seeing now during the Trump administration. With 1033, what they're doing to the police force.
I think if you look at the rollback of the restrictions on military transfers, the pardoning of Arpaio, this ramping up of the war on drugs, it's not clear how much concrete impact this is going to have on policing. It's as much a kind of theater about a politics of resentment and revenge. That, of course, could lead to much more serious changes. And I think one of the things that's most concerning about it is how much support he's getting, not so much from police leaders, but from police unions. So they're speaking out often in very positive ways, applauding these moves, even though we know that any kind of true effort at using police for public safety is not going to be consistent with using more bayonets and camouflage uniforms.
And 50 caliber machine guns.
Yes.
And armored personnel carriers. You actually write in your book, our entire criminal justice system has become a gigantic revenge factory. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that we've lost sight of the idea that the criminal justice system is about actually helping people. It's really about punishing people, even in the face of all evidence that it has no positive effect on public safety. You know, we've been waging a war on drugs for 40 years by putting people in prison for ever longer sentences, and drugs are cheaper, easier to get, and of higher quality than they've ever been. And any high school student in America can get any kind of drugs they want. And yet we persist in this idea that the way to respond to the problems of drugs and many other social problems is through arrests, courts, punishment, prisons. And this is what Trump is playing to, this idea that the only appropriate role for the state is one of coercion and threat, whether it's in the foreign policy sphere or in the domestic
Although
sphere.
Although in the book, you go back and write the history of policing, both in Britain and the United States, and how its roots are in attempts by the property class to crush dissent, or in the case of the United States, the slave patrols. I mean, that's its genesis.
I think one of the mistakes we need to be careful to avoid is thinking that if somehow we can just push back on some of the things that Sessions and Trump are pushing, that we'll achieve some kind of rational equilibrium on policing. But the problem is so much deeper than that. Even on 1033, the military transfer, it was Obama that dramatically ramped up that program, billions of dollars transferred. In addition,
which we should be clear, allows them to buy surplus military grade.
That's right. Humvees, right. Armored vehicles, bayonets, sniper rifles, and things like microwaves and Kevlar helmets. It's a huge range of material. But in addition, Homeland Security gives out tens of billions of dollars for direct purchases of this material, and Obama never said anything about that. And the reality is that while the Obama Justice Department brought more cases against police than all previous presidents combined, there's very little evidence of any kind of positive benefit from that. And the evidence they have is incredibly thin and has to do with changes in attitude, not changes in the actual outcome of overly aggressive and invasive policing.
Well, you write about how, you know, even when you have diversity within a police force, they are serving a system, which in your book you say is a system for managing and even producing inequality by suppressing social movements and tightly managing the behaviors of poor and non-white people.
Well, this is one of these fake reforms that's not going to make any difference. And Paul Butler in his new book, Chokehold, James Forman Jr. in his book, Locking Up Our Own, we're all on the same page. There's absolutely no evidence that diversifying police forces results in better outcomes for people, especially people of color. In fact, some of the evidence shows the outcomes are worse. These officers are embedded in institutions that have marching orders that come from political decision makers. And unless those marching orders are dramatically changed, those institutions are going to continue to wage a war on drugs and a war on crime and a war on the poor.
Which is a cover. I mean, let's be clear about the war on drugs. And this, I think you quote Ehrlichman in the book.
Yes, from the Nixon White House.
Right. I mean, they knew very well what they were doing.
Yes, the war on drugs has never been about public health or public safety. It's been about providing, as you said, cover for aggressive and invasive policing that targets almost exclusively people of color. And it's really about giving police tools to manage what our political leaders consider the dangerous classes.
Well, and you quote Christian Parente about how in the 1970s, the economy was, by design, crashed to create these pools of surplus and redundant labor, which we see in marginal communities, and then you had to bring in the policing mechanism and mass incarceration and a host of laws stripping them of their most basic rights, including the right to a trial, in order to keep them under control.
I think it's essential that when we talk about reforms of the criminal justice system, that we have a political and economic analysis that goes along with that. Otherwise, we're just spinning our wheels. We have to understand functionally what role the police have been given in managing the disorders, the dislocations of the new economy. And the reality is that the new neoliberal arrangements don't require a large industrial working class. And that is a role, and also large segments of the service economy even have been eliminated. And these were roles that were historically taken by African Americans and new immigrants. And this has produced profound social problems for the American society.
The response has been almost exclusively coercion through police.
Absolutely, because the neoliberal ideology says that the role of government is to subsidize the very wealthiest and the most powerful in hopes that their economic activity will become so robust, so powerful, so competitive that somehow, magically, the rest of the society will benefit from that. For 40 years, we've been told, well, it'll trickle down. But where's the trickle down? What we see is increasing homelessness, growing inequality, wage polarity, and the racial dimensions of this are as unequal as they've ever been.
You quote David Bailey, who says the police do not prevent crime.
So David Bailey was a very important police scholar, and he said, look, this is a myth. Police know it. Police scholars know it. The primary job of police has never been the management of crime. It's been the management of inequality. And we can see this throughout the earliest origins of policing. I argue in the book that the origins of policing are tied to three institutions. They are the management of the newly industrialized and urbanized working class to prevent riots, strikes, and other kinds of disorders, colonialization, and slavery. People often point to the London Metropolitan Police, who were formed in the 1820s by Sir Robert Peel, Robert Bob, the Bobbies. They are held up as this kind of liberal ideal of a dispassionate, politically neutral police with the support of the citizenry, but this really misreads the history.
We're going to come back to that. When we return, we'll hear more from Alex Vitale, author of The End of Policing. Contact with Chris Hedges. Welcome back to On Contact. We'll get back to our discussion with Alex Vitale, professor of sociology at Brooklyn College and the author of The End of Policing. So before the break, we were discussing Peel, London, Ireland.
So Peel is sent to manage the British occupation of Ireland, and he's confronted with a dilemma. Historically, peasant uprisings, rural outrages were dealt with by either the local militia or the British military. But in the wake of the Napoleonic Wars and the debts and the need for soldiers in other parts of the British Empire, he is having more and more difficulty managing these disorders. In addition, when he does call out the militia, what happens is often they end up opening fire on a crowd, killing lots of people, creating martyrs, inflaming further unrest. And he said, I need a force that can manage these outrages without inflaming passions further. And he develops the Peace Preservation Force, which is the first attempt to create a hybrid military-civilian force that can try to win over the population by embedding itself in local communities, taking on some crime control functions, but their primary purpose was always the manage of the occupation. He then exports that model to London as the industrial working classes are flooding the city, dealing with issues of poverty, cycles of boom and bust in the economy, and that becomes their primary mission.
And we had a very similar process in the United States, which you write about in the book. At one point, what do they call them, the Pennsylvania Cossacks, you know?
Yes. So the creation of the very first state police force in the United States is the Pennsylvania State Police in 2000.
Which was created for the same reasons.
For the same reasons, and in fact was modeled similarly on the U.S. occupation forces in the Philippines and there was a back and forth of personnel and ideas. And what was happening was that local police were unable to manage the coal strikes and iron strikes that were happening at the turn of the 19th century. And they needed a force that was more adherent to the interests of capital.
And we should just interrupt. We should be clear that one of the problems was when they recruited locally, there was too much sympathy for the working
class.
That's
right. Interestingly, for these small town police forces in a coal mining town, there was sometimes sympathy. They wouldn't open fire on the strikers. So the state police force was created to be that strong arm of the law. And again, the direct connection between colonialism and the domestic management of workers.
One of the things you write about in the book is how, especially with Wilson's gunboat diplomacy, you have all sorts of occupations, the Dominican Republic, Nicaragua, etc., and they will go down and organize an indigenous police presence that will serve the interests of American capitalists, like United Fruit. But it's that you quote someone who comes back and says all the things they've learned about repressive techniques and then imported into the United States.
It's a two-way exchange. So we're developing ideas through our own colonial undertakings, bringing those ideas home, and then refining them and shipping them back to our partners around the world who are often despotic regimes with close economic relationships to the United States. So there's a very sad history here of the U.S. exporting basically models of policing that morph into death squads and horrible human rights abuses.
Given the deformation of the United States, the ascendancy of a corporate, global, oligarchic elite, to what extent has the American policing system become an occupation force?
Well, I think that it functions differently for different parts of the population. I think it's clear that if you talk to young people of color, especially, you know, young males in a lot of hard-hit parts of the country, that's the way they see the police. That's the way they experience the police. The police are not there to keep them safe.
Well, they're terrified with good reason.
You know, on the one hand, these folks have safety problems. You know, if you're a young person in parts of Chicago, you need help in maintaining safety. In fact, that's one of the things that's driving gang formation there. But the police are not capable and not always even interested in providing that important safety for them. That then engenders other kinds of problems that get met with a repressive response. So it begins to look, you know, like in parts of Chicago, like a kind of failed state where normal systems of regulation, of managing social problems have broken down, and there's basically a kind of war mentality between police and large segments of the young people there.
You talk in the book about the programs that allow police to expropriate property and money, and what that has done to police departments.
Well, this is just one of the forms of corruption that emerges from some of the functional roles that police have been given in this era. So, most importantly, the war on drugs has radically expanded police power. It has eroded the Fourth Amendment, and the asset forfeiture laws that were created as part of the war on drugs.
Explain how those work, because you don't even have to be convicted of a crime.
No, only your money does.
Yeah.
And the standards are civil standards, not criminal standards, which means that it only requires a preponderance of the evidence rather than guilt beyond reasonable doubt.
Well, in the book, you talk about how these police forces would go out, I think you call them fishing expeditions.
Absolutely. The way the asset forfeiture laws are generally structured is police get to keep all or a significant share of the money, and they have created their own internal...
Well, and the vehicles,
and houses, and anything else they find. But what they really
and,
want...
And let's be clear, what they're doing is targeting someone who they think is dealing in drugs without...
Well, no, I don't even think they necessarily think that. The targeting is so much vaguer than that. Mm. And in some cases, there's evidence of targeting people just because they think they have money on them. So they're making stops and claiming that, based on their own internal decision-making, that, well, anyone who's carrying more than $500 must be up to no good. Because what law-abiding person would be carrying $1,000 with them? The fact that that person is on the way to the doctor's office to pay a bill or has just come from a check-cashing place is not of interest to them. If they're suspicious of that person, they make a confiscation right on the spot, and then you have to prove that your money is not guilty after the fact.
Which most people can't do.
Many people certainly can't do that. They don't have the financial proof that the money has been garnered in a particular way. And, you know, there are large segments of the economy now that operate on a cash basis. And those people now are at risk from this kind of predatory
policing.
Well,
you see it with the fines in places like St. Louis and Ferguson.
That's another example. And across large parts of the South, it's especially common in rural areas as state funding for local places has declined as part of austerity politics. Local areas are trying to make up that money through fees and fines.
Which get ridiculous. Like, you can't stand more than 3 minutes on a street. You know, you didn't mow your lawn.
Right. Not only are the laws ridiculous, but the patterns of enforcement are ridiculous. And then the fact that judges go along with this is a further outrage. And in some cases, it's resulted in debtors' prisons, where people who can't pay the fines are coerced into getting money from friends and family, not just to bail themselves out, but to come up with a deal on all the fine money, and they can't get out of jail until they pay it.
You are quite critical of what's called the broken windows policing policy. Explain what it is and why.
So a lot of what's happening in terms of the over-policing of communities of color is not about arresting homicidal maniacs or rapists. It's about the constant, invasive, harassing, low-level enforcement of very minor violations of the law.
This is Garner selling loose cigarettes,
which shouldn't even be a police matter. But the mayor of New York, like many politicians across the country, is committed to this idea that if they aggressively micromanage the public behavior of poor people, that will lead to public safety, a revitalization of neighborhoods, et cetera. But the whole precept behind it is fundamentally racist. We know that the architects of this theory were of a mind that poor people are, by their nature, incapable of regulating their own behavior, and it's only a coercive state that will force them to do the right thing.
You say it's essentially it shifts the burden of responsibility for the declining living conditions onto the poor themselves.
It was revolutionary. They took what was a very well understood idea that poverty and social dislocation leads to crime, and instead said that it's disorder that produces crime.
Let me ask about the independent training companies. Because so much when we talk about professionalizing the police, which you point out in the book, is really about militarizing the police.
Well, the number one demand you hear from police reformers, especially those who have ties to research departments, the criminal justice programs, a lot of the liberal, very well-meaning organizations, they're like, we need better training. But training is actually most likely part of the problem, and there are two elements to that. One is, there is this warrior mindset that gets expressed through training that teaches police that every encounter they have with the public could be their last. And they're shown these videos of seemingly innocuous encounters that go bad. And the message is, you know, shoot first, ask questions later. And we've seen that occur time Right. after time across the U.S. The other is the growth of these paramilitary units, SWAT teams that have exploded. Look at Radley Balco's book on this subject. And that ethos has pervaded police departments, and part of the way it's done that is through paramilitary training that's been farmed out to military training organizations that advertise.
Sometimes the Israelis.
sometimes the Israelis, but others, they claim, well, we train special forces in Peru and the U.S. Marines, and we'll come and do close combat training for your SWAT team. Well, in a lot of departments, SWAT teams are part-time assignments. They also have patrol assignments. So that whole ethos seeps throughout the whole department. And that really feeds this whole ideology that policing is about a war footing, that the public or large segments of it are the enemy to be controlled, and that the way you manage social problems is through more firepower. And of course, that's exactly what Trump is trying to tap into, is that sentiment that the solution to every problem is more punitiveness, more coerciveness, more militarization.
We'll stop there. Thank you. Thank you for joining us. That was Alex Vitale, author of End of Policing. If the state of siege imposed by militarized police forces on our inner cities were lifted, if prisoners were allowed to return to their communities, and if evictions which destroy the cohesion and solidarity of a neighborhood were to end, the corporate state would face a rebellion. It needs to maintain these pod-like police states if it is to continue the relentless drive to further impoverish the country in the name of austerity. The continued cutting or closing of the few social services that keep people from facing total destitution, the massive unemployment and underemployment that is never addressed, the despair, the hopelessness, the retreat into drugs and alcohol to blunt the pain, the heavy burden of debt peonage that sees families thrown out of their homes, the desperate struggle to make money from the illegal economy, and the forced bankruptcies all are about social control. Until the police cease to serve this exploitive system, all talk of reform will be a waste of breath.